That's Ray Barreto, one of the greatest percussionists of all time on congas, and also a band leader and also a composer. We lost him some years ago, but his music remains an emphatic statement of his commitment to culture. The song is titled, or the tune is titled, Power, the title track from his award-winning 1970 album, Barreto Power. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're closing out this week, the last week of the year, talking about the issues and events that, in your view, shaped the world, if you will, or just simply that it was, in your view, these things were the most significant developments in the year 2016. Yesterday, we got a lot of focus on Israel, and I think we agreed that the situation there, while it is being made to look like it is different, it's the same. It's the same. And so we will continue to explore today those issues that you think in 2016, those issues that for you were most significant or had the greatest impact. And of course, we'll further delve into your views by asking why you think this. Why do you think the particular issue or event should be considered among the most significant or among those having the greatest impact? There's no right or wrong or anything like that. It's just what you think. And what we're interested in is why you think the way you think. The number to call is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. By the way, this is the third of 7 days of Kwanzaa and dedicated to the principle of Ujima, collective work and responsibility. The idea is to inculcate in the African American community in particular a set of principles, a set of guidelines for conducting ourselves. And it's a very good idea. It's a very good idea to promote this kind of effort, because as in any fragmented community, people look for some kind of guideline as to how they can proceed with principles. We've always had principles. I don't want to suggest that we never had them. But it is a more formalized way, and it is a way for the African community all over the world to unite. So this concept was advanced by Maulana Karenga many years ago, and it was just put forward as an idea, as a way of becoming closer together. And there are 7 days. We are in day three with the principle of Ujima collective work and responsibility being the guiding principle for today. It's a great idea. All right, so as we look back at 2016 and we are on the cusp of 2017, there's much that we need to consider. No matter what community you come from, but we have to take a look at how we are proceeding with this idea that we introduced some time ago of having a point of reckoning about a bunch of things, and don't put it off, don't let it slide. This is the time to come to some definitive decisions and conclusions about where we are and where we choose to go in the new year. If we don't do this kind of work, we really will suffer terribly. Because, as you know, I don't want to inculcate a sense of fear or anything like that, because no matter what is coming down the pike, at this moment, we are not prepared. We just are not prepared. So discussing these things puts it in our heads that we should begin, if we haven't already, we should seriously begin preparation on so many different levels, not just for what is our relationship with society, but really, if you look at it this way, of developing self-independence. It involves doing some heavy thinking and the formulation of a working plan. I just mentioned the 7 principles that were laid out that have been adopted widely, not just throughout the United States, but in other African communities throughout the world. And it was in recognition of the very same thing, that the African American community needed something to encourage this kind of discussion and the formulation of a plan. And this was a way of getting people to begin the process to become familiar with thinking first, thinking and putting into practice what you think. From Chicago, Henry, you are starting us off today. How are you doing?
Hey, Therese, how's it going?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing good, doing good. Greetings to the you and the PRN audience.
Thank you.
I wanted to do this. I got 3 stories that I think were important, and all 3 of them consist of a local, national, and international news that I think is very important to the significance of the year 2016. Starting with the local, you know, from Chicago, from where I'm from, I think the significance of the 700 homicides that has happened here in Chicago, the most since the 90s. And I say that's significant because of the fact that this is a result of policies that have gone on throughout the previous years, the closing of 50 schools a couple of years ago, the budget cuts that Governor Rauner has done within the African-American and Latino communities, and other things that the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois has done to escalate this violence within our community. So you're seeing the result of this this year with 700 deaths. Within the African American and Latino communities. On a national scale, I think everybody has pointed out the election has been a big and huge major story because of the fact that, you know, we've seen many things happen this election that is probably eye-opening and is so blatant, you know, from the fact of racism to the fact of voter fraud and you know, other stuff that we've talked about in regards to undemocratic processes that have gone on in this election. And on an international scale, one of the things that the stories that I had kept my eye on was the coup that almost happened in Turkey. And I say that's very important because, you know, it was big news in July, then all of a sudden it just stopped. You know, it's like nobody started talking about it. And I think this is something that we have to really, really keep our eye on because of the fact that, you know, I think there are forces that are trying to destabilize that country in Turkey, you know, as far as Turkey, because I think it's a very, very important piece of the Middle East. You know, I know everybody's focused on Syria and what's going on there, but Turkey is a very, very important part of the Middle East because of the fact that, you know, it has the largest the largest gas reserves in the world. It has the 10th largest military, and it is a nuclear nation. So, you know, we got to basically keep an eye on that situation as well because, you know, whatever happens in Turkey, you know, might escalate, you know, to a global war, you know, especially with the way that our country likes to destabilize certain nations, and because of the fact that this president seems to, you know, be at odds, you know, with the United States now, it seems to be very important to pay attention to what's going on in Turkey because there's a lot of instability going on in that country.
Well, let's talk about the first thing that you talked about, which is the situation in Chicago, the violence that has reached what people would consider to be epic proportions. And I agree with you about the role of organized government and policies that simply haven't been able to deal with this. But I'm more concerned about what you think about the internal problem, that is the communities themselves being unable to do something. Or what do you think might be contributing factors from the communities themselves?
I think the problem is that we rely too much on the government to help us out. And the problem is that we're not understanding that the government is complicit in these issues that we're having. So it's up to us to take the mantle of doing something for ourselves to help quell this problem.
Henry, that the problem is so dangerous now. It has reached to such a point where there's a feeling that it's outside of the capacity of people to fix it. I mean, this level of violence has not been seen in a long time. And we look at all of the dynamics of it, you know, young people killing each other, the clear availability of weapons people can put their hands on. But it also speaks to something, don't you think, about the total deterioration, a real disconnect between, you know, value for life and what that says. that a person can casually kill another person, and that would be, you know, not at all exceptional or out of the ordinary. What has happened in Chicago, in your view, that we've reached this level where the inhumanity of the violence itself seems to be distorted as a kind of, well, I killed my first person, you know, it's therefore it's a mark of a graduation into violence. The new sets of laws and the new modes of conduct, what is it saying about family life? Apart from the fact, you know, of the role of the government and so forth, is this fixable?
It's fixable. It'll take a lot of work. But, you know, this level of violence that is being implanted in the psyche of, you know, not only just residents here in Chicago, but, you know, this is a national thing. You know, when you see violence on TV, I mean, it's like an American culture. And our children are growing up on this stuff, you know. And, you know, because I, myself, I have to be very careful, especially like with my children, on when they watch the news, because I have to explain to them the contents of what's being displayed, you know, on this news broadcast, because most of the time on the news, we're talking, you know, we're seeing, you know, the top stories in the news is, and especially here in Chicago, is, you know, a shooting in a neighborhood, a police officer killing another unarmed black man, or we're seeing, you know, wars going on perpetrated by us overseas. So violence is like the American way. And it's like, you know, when our children see this stuff, you know, they think it's normal. And we as a community have to, you know, have to let them know and to, you know, educate them on how, you know, the society is legitimizing, you know, the killing of, you know, black people and, you know, people of color. So when you see that, you know, you start to develop a self-hatred for yourself because of the fact that you see so many, you know, black and non-white people just being killed, you know, for no apparent reason. And you kind of think it's normal.
What does it say? 888-874-4888. What does it say about this whole notion? I mean, America it was violent. It has always been violent. It was forged in the crucible of violence. Mm-hmm. So violence is, I agree with you there. Violence is very American in terms of a social value, if you want to call it that. But I'm particularly concerned about zeroing in on the communities that are experiencing levels of violence that we have not seen in a very, very, very long time, if at all. And we look at who is committing the violence and who is the victim of violence. And we're seeing that they're younger. We're seeing that the violence is connected with other kinds of activities like drugs. We're seeing that the violence is now a kind of mark of accomplishment in a culture that we really don't know this culture. We really can't wrap our heads around this culture. Somebody looks at you the wrong way, and the answer is, you know, bullets flying. Petty things that are triggering this level of violence. So do you have any particular take on this? Because it isn't as simple. I know you know that. It's not as simple as, well, policies are inadequate and policies contribute. And we can easily identify these policies, like unemployment. We have fewer and fewer resources to promote, you know, growth and self responsibilities. You know, things like that go back to jobs again and other ways in which society normally makes available ways that people can grow. Education, you're right about that when we talked about the closing of schools in Chicago. But is there something else that is particularly, is this a statement about a total breakdown, an almost total breakdown of family life and family structure in our community?
Oh, yeah, I mean, in a sense, yes. And I'll say this, you know, my organization during the summer, we actually went out to the streets, went out to some of the, you know, most violent neighborhoods in Chicago to kind of talk to some of the, you know, residents there and also some of the young people that are, quote unquote, misguided or whatever terminology you want, you know, other people to call them. But when I talk to these, you know, young brothers and some sisters, it's all a matter of them not having resources to have enough to sustain their own lives. And these are people that are going into adulthood with basically no hope because of the fact that, you know, most of them, you know, are not formally educated. They don't have a job. And their only means of access of any type of resources is through the streets. So when I see this, you know, I this is what prompted me to, you know, look at the policies that have happened, you know, the previous years to see how the level of violence in Chicago has escalated. So, you know, if there's something else that I'm missing here, you know, I'm definitely blind to it. And maybe, you know, I'm just not seeing the overall picture. But, you know, this is just from my experience of, you know, talking to, you know, some of these young brothers and sisters, you know, out in the streets. I mean, you know, there was one young brother who was very receptive to our group when we went out to the streets talking to them. And, you know, all he wanted was to just get his GED and get a job. And so, you know, one of the young women in our group, you know, she has access to, you know, she knows somebody in the GED program. And basically, you know, she helped him out into, you know, getting his GED and he got a job. So when we came back to the neighborhood, he was so happy to see her. He just gave her a hug because of the fact that all he wanted was a chance. And I think that's the basic problem with some of these young people is all they want is a chance, you know, to be self-sustaining within our society.
Well, thank you for getting us started and planting this in our heads. And you're absolutely right. This is a national crisis, and we really ought to be paying attention to it because it is inextricably tied to the welfare of the entire community. This is not an isolated thing, but it is now an integral part of community life. And so we have to take a look at it. Thank you so much for calling in and contributing today. From Brooklyn, David, you're on the air.
Well, I wasn't planning to call today, but I have, after hearing Henry, I had to do it because we're leaving certain things out. Me, I have been a student of Dr. John Henry Clark, and I remember one of the things that I learned from him is that your oppressor teaches you to hate yourself. That's what he does. And that is part of the system of white supremacy racism that we have here. So the victims of it can be put into that position of looking at other people like them through their eyes, through the eyes of their oppressor. And I think that is important to know. Also, I can remember when I started school in the 30s through the primary, the secondary, the tertiary schools that I went to, I can't remember having one African-American teacher, not at all, at that time. I did not learn anything positive in any of those divisions, positive about people that looked like me. I had no books that had anything to do with someone looking like me. So if I didn't have the things at home in my family, I could be one of those people who learned to hate myself. And fortunately, I was not able to do that. In my book, Playing the Game, as you know, I tell a story about when I was taking some of my students for the lessons out at the airport. That's at when I was at Wingate High School. And you know my rules about dress, shirt and tie, no sneakers and all that, and well-groomed. And we are coming back from the airport on the bus, and we stopped right in front of the school. That day, some young person had brought a gun to school, and there was some disturbance with this gun. It was fired, and the television cameras from one of the local stations, I can't remember, was NBC, CBS, ABC, they were all out in front of the school as we arrived. And as we got out of the bus, that's all my students, maybe 20 students, all well-dressed students of color in white shirts, ties, no sneakers, regular trousers. And these people had cameras out there. Do you know that none of those people operating those cameras and were interested whatsoever in taking a picture or a video of these well-behaved, well-groomed scholars coming from their lessons out at Republic Airport? They were only interested in the situation with the youngster who brought a gun. So you're taught to hate yourself. You don't learn positive things. And these things where the media is emphasizing these gun battles, these murders of black folks in places like Chicago, that is put out on the air every day to give a certain message to the masses of people who live in the country. That's what it is. So we have a situation where we have people who do not support justice for us, and then we are taught to hate ourselves quite often. So it's no problem with someone looking like you to pull out a firearm and dispatch you right on the scene.
Well, I appreciate that point of view, but we still can't deny that this is a huge problem, whether the media covers it with that intent, as you just laid out, or not. This is a problem, and it is getting worse and worse. And we are seeing very few, if any, effort being mobilized to intervene or to try and get this thing under control, to the point where it is all but said that you can't control it. Let them continue to the point where they kill themselves. I've seen comments even going to the point of saying, well, hey, they're performing a service. They're killing each other. We don't want them anyway. So they are performing a kind of perverse public service by killing themselves.
And the rate of
killing is going up and up, but it is also part of, when you look at it in the context of where we are, it speaks to cleavage within the community. It speaks to the relationship of our communities to the larger world. It speaks to the role of government. It speaks to so many things. But most of all, it is a problem that the traditional organizations and people and systems that would normally have been activated in the way of responding to a crisis, we're not seeing this being treated as a crisis. We're seeing it as, you know, just what you said, you know, the news media portraying it as a particular trait of inner city communities. And, things, the kinds of ways that they, quote, behave, unquote. So this is the dilemma. We know that there's so much interest in portraying the negative so as to satisfy the large narrative about African Americans and how they behave with each other. But then that still doesn't solve the problem. That still isn't a sufficient enough explanation for what needs to be done. Because it is a crisis. It has to be paid attention to.
I think at the there are many solutions or many things that can be done. But for starters, for example, here in New York, you have a city council. And you have a situation that we're talking about that has its economic, social, and political underpinnings. Why does the city council, full of people of color, go and vote to hire thousands more policemen rather than using that money economically to provide jobs, to be the employer of last resort, to provide youth jobs, and do the type of things that would benefit economically the target population that is involved in this type of behavior? Also, other social things that could be done in terms of all the situations you have with health and all the factors that impact on the people who are involved in this type of behavior. So I think we need to make choices. I rather have these youngsters that are doing these things, be able to get jobs rather than hiring more police and correction officers to lock them up in jail, which was the big solution that Clinton had. That's why the jail population expanded from the 70s, where it was 200,000 people in the country, to 2,500,000. So there are no perfect solutions, but for me, that is something that could be a start.
Well, thank you for your opinions, and thank you for contributing so meaningfully, as always, today. Thank you so much. We'll take a little break and come back to your ideas and beliefs about the year that is about to close out, the year 2016. What do you consider to be the most significant issues that were raised that came to your attention, and what can we do about it going into 2017? We'll be right back. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. As the year closes out, we're encouraging a discussion today about the most important or most significant stories or events or issues that, in your mind, needed to be cited for the year 2016 and the impact of these issues and events on you. Why would you select these things as being significant, the most significant, or those things that are having or did have the greatest impact in 2016? The number to call is 888-874-4888. We haven't at all abandoned, in fact, this is very much what it is. Our continuing discussion is about continuing the discussion on the point of reckoning we ought to have. We must come to a point of reckoning about the system that we live in and about our work that we should be doing to get a fix on where we locate ourselves with respect to the system that governs us all. We have to come to some truths about it. We have to get, my favorite word, some clarity about the system. And not just about the system, but about us as well. We have to examine and dig a little deeper and get to a point where we understand things. Because part of the problem, I think, is that we may think we understand things, but what we are doing actually is we understand how people are telling us to understand things. This is a process that I think you need to do for yourself. And same with me. Understand it for yourself. And you come to conclusions that are quite finite. And more importantly, you begin to understand yourself as a committed political person. And I'm not talking about the traditional kind of politics where, you know, you're affiliated with this party and the party says this, so therefore you say that. So, no. This is about you independently examining. And you will find a lot of contradictions as you examine. And that is fantastic if you do, because now you are faced with the matter of choosing which way you go. But you are girded and you are grounded in a kind of truth, a self-discovered truth that you can't, nobody could shake you. Nobody could manipulate you easily. And you become more and more mature in your thinking. And therefore, you would know where to spend your energy, what to spend your energy on, where and how you enter the fray, what you will become involved in, what you absolutely won't stand for. These are vital things that we should do, because the system has it already defined in its interests. But if you listen to Henry and you listen to David, what we're getting from both of them, which is absolutely true, is that we have or we are given an understanding of things, which comes loaded with a lot of baggage having to do with how we're manipulated, how we are taught to think, how our mindset is shaped, but very little of it having anything to do with what we really want to know or what we really are concerned about. That story that David told about, you know, pulling up at the school just as the media were at its front doors covering a young kid with a gun or reports of a person with a gun, and that was where they went. That was where the story went. Although the bus of the students that he was bringing back to the school, by the way, he taught aviation. He taught young people in the neighborhood, same kind of young people, like the people who they prefer not to cover. These are not people who carried guns, but these are people who learned how to fly planes, aeroplanes, regular kids. And so when you have your program, and that's really what the significance of his story was. He was engaging young people in a viable career, engaging them at a level they normally would not have had exposure to this kind of program. Which young black kid would you ever expect to tell you how they're excited about learning how to fly planes and going on to be part of that community of pilots? He was training young people to be pilots. That is not of interest. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say it's discouraged. You don't want to give young black children any hope that these are things that they can do. Because the mindset, the social mindset being shaped across the country and even across much of the world is that this is not for you. You don't belong here. So if we accept it without examining this one thing, look how much would have been lost. Look how much would have been lost in terms of innate human capital that we have within our communities. I used to train people. I didn't require any previous experience whatsoever. But I tell you, if you give me your body, mind, and soul for 20 weeks, you could be making a living as a reporter. I wasn't kidding. And it was done. We did that. There was no way. You look at CNN and you look at the New York Times, and there are a lot of people who came out of my program who would not have had any positive reception from schools of journalism, because number one is, this is not for you. And I didn't require that they had, the only thing I required was you should have a high school diploma. I didn't require college degree. But I told them, it's going to be one of the hardest things you ever did. But I'm walking with you every step of the way. And I don't accept failure and defeat. If you hold to your end of the bargain, you can pretty much count on 20 weeks later, you can walk into a newspaper or radio station and earn a living as a professional. So if you change, you would not believe that the biggest obstacle, people sent observers, professors of journalism from all over the country to come and observe my program. And I never told them what the secret was. Never told them. They thought, well, it might have been the unique curriculum. Yes, the curriculum was unique. No question about that. But that was not the secret. I had a full-time psychotherapist because I knew the greatest obstacle that I would face is their mindset. They were programmed for life to fail, to accept failure. And you have to undo that every day. You have to do something to radically alter that way of thinking. Because they got it from their friends, they got it from their families, they got it from their environment, that you just are not going to succeed. You're not destined for success. I knew that that was one brilliant stroke. I knew that the vast majority of the time, it will be a psychological block that would be between the participants of the program and the eventual goal of success. No question. So unless you see that and you prepare for it, you have to undo that thinking. So therefore, I could not approach teaching the way any regular teacher would teach. You can't do that. If you mean to succeed and to help people succeed, you cannot use the system's methods. That's not what they're designed for. They're not designed for success. So you got to come up with an approach that is radically different. Very, very different. And the main task is to undo that rotten thinking that is institutionalized. I had one of the highest rates of success. In fact, the program was rated the most effective training program in the state of New York. And everybody was interested. Oh, let's see your curriculum. You could see the curriculum, but you're not understanding. You would have no appreciation at all of what it took to get people on track to success. It's psychological. So, oh, by the way, the number is 888-874-4888. We took a little side turn there. But it is important, these things to consider in your own life. And this is why you ought to have a point of reckoning with the system. The system is meticulously, scientifically devised to achieve goals it wishes to achieve. And you always have to have clarity about it. When you can spot, oh, well, this is the system stuff. I don't need that. Or the basic, the mainstream media is reporting A, B, C, D, and E. I have to be very careful about what I extract from their reports. I cannot let my guard down and believe everything that they report as true. I remember I was covering a federal court in Brooklyn, and a reporter from the New York Times, who by then had gotten quite a few bylines on a very big case, came to me. You know, I have my little paper, came to me and asked me questions that blew my mind, having to do with basics Who is that person over there? What is this? What is that? And you're working professionally at the New York Times. Well, there you go. If the New York Times finds that your level of performance is okay for the paper, why is it my job to now be your personal tutor? It's not my job. You go to your editors at the New York Times and you tell them that what you have been taught at the New York Times is insufficient. I bet you that never occurred. From New Hampshire, Jean, you're on the air.
Hi, Catrice.
Hello.
Thank you very much for your contribution to journalism. It's wonderful.
Thanks. Thank you.
I wanted to bring up the fact you were talking about the significant things that happened in 2016 for me. One of them is the fact that Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize of Literature, because it brought my feeling of being American, because I see him is somewhat older than me, but in my age group, and that his contribution to me as a teenager was acknowledged by internationally, and it brought up the feeling for me of being American. And I thought that because Bob Dylan, the way it was acknowledged was a spiritual acknowledgement, because his words are very spiritual, and what I think is that we need more spiritual leadership. And what I wanted to ask you is, I remember there was that Million Man March.
Yes.
And that was like extraordinarily effective on crime for many years. It lasted a really long time. Like immediately after that march, crime went down. And I'm wondering if maybe another one would help. For some reason, there was a tremendous power in that.
Well, there was power in it, but I also believe there was a missed opportunity as well.
Oh.
And that is, and we had this discussion with Henry some time ago when he organized a small version of the concept of community empowerment, and it was successful. And I said, okay, great, you got a whole bunch of people together, and they did the thing that you wanted, your envision, the outcome was right on point. Did you have some cards or something to... This is a lesson from Kwame Ture. Mm. He kept talking about it is important not only to mobilize, but to organize. And wherever you are able to mobilize massive crowds of people, you should have a plan of implementing organization. It is an opportunity to organize. Mm-hmm. And that was what was missing, I think, from the Million Man March. It was successful. The objective was pretty simple, but very powerful, which was to get the people that are regarded by the society as the problems of society and the reason to fear black people and so forth. But you saw them there in an extraordinary demonstration of togetherness. And you saw them there gathered literally by the millions. It was more than a million. But they affirmed their rights and so forth. And this was beautiful. But I looked very carefully for evidence of organization. And regrettably, I mean, it did have a continuing effect. But I think that should have been a central part of the purpose of the drive, to instill this idea that people must become very, very keen about the power of organization. You have to organize. And because if you don't organize after mobilizing, then you missed an opportunity, a great opportunity to continue the struggle at an entirely different level. So think what would have happened had the Million Man March had its center, not only this affirmation, this brotherhood and expression of brotherhood and so forth, but it was a way of directing energy at something that would in turn have spread throughout the community as a very positive force. And I think that that was one of the major problems that I had with the march, that it was a missed opportunity. Now, you can't argue about the importance of the march or the benefits of the march, but it was a significant omission to have mobilized all these people, and we had no organized effort except go back to your community and make some changes. Well, you have to basically give people a guideline of what they can do. Make it easier. Each person walking out of there should have had a packet about how you create change in your community. And these are the things that you can do. Or join this organization. Become a member. This is how we can put our heads together and get things done.
Unfortunately, the organizers, the mobilizers in that event were religious. And you're talking about the political side, so there's got to be some kind of a collaboration between, because otherwise they would be handing out the Kabbalah instead of a packet.
No, so, I think it's not as severely distinct as you would say or you would think, but it is, in fact.
I mean the Quran.
It could be
I'm
one
sorry,
and the same.
Quran.
The Quran, yeah, the Kabbalah
yeah.
is Jewish.
But sorry.
It could be one and the same. It doesn't have to have any religious aspect to it. It is just about organizing everybody trained on the whole idea that we've got to start change in our community. And here are five simple ways. Here are five simple ways to change your block or your community. And you can form your own organizations, but follow these five principles. You would have had incredible change coming out of that. I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm just saying that this is what we have to begin to consider. Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of the program, and you can stay tuned, because coming up next is the NDC Slave Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, and we can continue the conversation tomorrow. See you. Bye-bye.